Love Bristol. Love BCMM 93.2.
A Bristol kind of love.
Unless we can be successful in creating a real free press where the American people get different viewpoints other than those expressed in the establishment-controlled media, there's going to be a civil war in this country, and it's going to come soon. The only thing that can stop it is by waking up vast amounts of sleeping people. Sheeple is what they are. They are following the Judas goat right into the shearing pens, and from there they will go to the slaughter, and they will not know that anything is wrong until they smell the blood of the sheeple in front of them.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Our governments are deliberately misleading us, so says Sara Bajk, the wife of top IBM executive lost on the Malaysian airliner. As more and more families of those lost on Malaysian MH370 believe their governments are lying to them, we hear from one who believes her government's deliberately misleading the families. And also, Martin Summers wonders, have we been here before? And brings us his Hereford Triangle, the disappearing aircraft special. Plus, as NATO defence ministers get together at Brussels at NATO headquarters, we hear what their commander-in-chief, the bizarrely named General Philip Breedlove, and Obama have to say about Ukraine. And we round off our interview from the other week with what the BBC are not reporting on, that is Occupy London, which is still going strong as a think tank this week. Some solutions, just so Osborne and the Treasury can't say nobody told them, with Occupy London's Clive Menzies. And part three of Paul Mason's series, actually part four, I think, this week, of the series that he thinks could not be made in Britain on the First World War, the People's First World War. But first is Osborne's austerity, like a badger coal trial that's failed and best confined to the dustbin. Well, I think Andrew Fisher might agree with that, because he's a former parliamentary researcher who's written a book called The Failed Experiment. And I'm hoping very much that he's joining us on the line now. Andrew, are you there?
I am. Hi. Yes, okay. I'm sorry, Tony.
Okay, Andrew, could you just tell us a bit about yourself? You were doing a bit of parliamentary research, and I imagine you've got a bit of studying under your belt.
Well, I've got an MA, if we're going to be boastful about that sort of thing. I then went to work in Parliament for a charity for a couple of years before that as a researcher. I now work for one of the biggest trade unions in the country as a policy officer. So I've had an interest in the economy and politics, obviously, for a long time. So, yeah, and I've just written a book. It's, as you said, called The Failed Experiment, which is about the economic consensus that has dominated British politics for the entirety of my lifetime, I'm afraid to say, probably since the late 70s. So I sort of argue why that consensus needs to be abandoned now. And I think it's obviously quite an urgent thing, because what we've seen since the crash is actually it's come back. It's that consensus has re-emerged and indeed sustained throughout the crisis.
Well, we call it the crash, don't we? But actually what was happening there was, at least what we're being told, was that the crash was being avoided, and that what we were doing was trying to stop actual crash happening. Can you just go back to 2008 and give us your take on what happened then? Because I was very, very disturbed the other week to hear that the Bank of England have shredded all their records in the run-up to that. It just sounds to me like criminals covering their tracks.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's remarkable about that period is there was a huge amount of political consensus established itself very quickly. I mean, I think for most people in Britain, the crisis didn't really occur until the Northern Rock collapse. And, you know, there were people queuing around the block in late 2007, and that's when people thought, wait a minute, this is something unusual. I mean, indeed, it hadn't happened since the middle of the 19th century in Britain before. So people sort of woke up to that, but very quickly, politicians panicked initially because I don't think they understood what was happening, either on this side of the Atlantic or in the US. But very quickly, there was a consensus re-established. Firstly, we must bail out the banks. And you know, people talk about we've taken them into public ownership, we nationalised the banks. We didn't, really. We privatised public money to bail out the banks. That's what happened. We don't really own the banks or control them. I mean, look at what's happened with RBS this week. They've announced the sacking of another another set of thousands of staff, closure of branches. You know, that's not in the public interest, and yet it's 83% publicly owned. Then there was quantitative easing. No real debate about that. Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? It was just a consensus. You know, the Bank of England must effectively print money in order to sustain the banking sector and you know, refloat it in a sense. And then since then we've had the consensus that austerity's got to happen. There's got to be huge cuts in public spending to pay for the crisis. And there's, again, very little debate, or debate within very tight confines, you know, a few percentage points here and there between the main political parties about what should happen. And I think there needs to be a clearer understanding about what actually happened in 2007-08, and then actually a re-evaluation of what we should have done about it instead.
How do these consensuses get formed, if you can use that word? Because it sounds to me like a load of people turning up at a meeting, maybe a press conference or whatever, having had a chat down the pub beforehand first and really decided what they're going to say, what they're going to do, and yet what they're doing is they're spending massive amounts of public money. The best place to decide how that's happened is through some sort of democratic process, not with a few mates in a bar in the city.
I agree entirely. I think what happened initially, I think if you look at the parliamentary debates at the time, there's very few MPs actually engaged with it. If you listen, you know, you look at the Hansard records now of the debates or watch it on Parliament TV, very few MPs are actually engaged with this because actually I think, like, to be frank, a lot of the bankers and a lot of the regulators, they didn't understand what was going on. I don't think most... I didn't before this, so I'll be honest here. I didn't know what a collateralised debt obligation was. I didn't know what a credit default swap was until the crash started happening. I looked it up and I got into it pretty quickly after that. But, you know, these sort of things that were happening, our MPs didn't have a clue about it. So there was a large degree of politicians being reliant on others for information. And where did they go to for that information? Well, we saw it with who did the government immediately get to advise them on what to do about Northern Rock. It was the, you know, the investment banks. That was who was drafted in to advise them. So this consensus happened, I think, partially due to ignorance, is the more benign view, but also because there just wasn't any other political alternative and hadn't been for a generation, really, to the market. The market knows best. You know, Labour put off nationalising Northern Rock for as long as possible. Remember, it was a Labour government then. Alistair Darling was the Chancellor, Gordon Brown Prime Minister. And they put it off for as long as possible. They spent £100 million of taxpayers' money trying to do anything to prop up Northern Rock and the rest of the banking system without having to go for the, in inverted commas, nationalisation option. And so I just think there wasn't really the consciousness, the political awareness that there is some other option than, you know, just throwing money at these things to bail them out.
I suppose the obvious thing to ask you now, Andrew, is if you'd have been had the ear of the Chancellor at the time, Alistair Darling, what would you have been saying to him? Hang on, here's a plan B for you, that he could have then gone about building his own consensus around, which would have been working in the public interest rather than in the private banker's interest, because that's clearly who that consensus was working for, having massive amounts of public money poured into the banks with no guarantee of it ever coming back.
Well, I think we have to start from one thing they did get right, is that they did actually have to bail it out. I mean, when you look at the banks, they hold our savings, they hold our pensions, you know, the wider finance sector, our saving, you know, our wages are paid into our bank accounts, our bills are paid through them. You can't just let all that collapse overnight. You know, the government had to step in. But what it should have done is nationalised it, and by that I mean taken control, not given it public money, which is...
Well, effectively, sorry to interrupt, Andrew, but effectively, surely that's what we've done. It's just that we haven't actually exercised that control as shareholders in making decisions about hiring and firing on bank boards, yeah, and actually placing people who we know and trust are going to be working in the public interest on those boards.
Well, exactly, and that's what should have happened. So it may sound like a fairly minor difference, but actually, if you're acting in the public interest, which, you know, it may be a naive view, but that's what I think, and that's what I think most people think governments should do, is act in the public interest. That's what would have happened. We would have had banks that acted in the public interest.
And could we still do that?
Of course. Of course. I mean, we own 83% of RBS. And it's interesting. If you go back to the Treasury Select Committee at the time, they held an inquiry into the Northern Rock bailout and public ownership, effectively, that happened. And the chief executive, or the head of the CBI, I forget his exact title, I think Director General they call them, of the CBI, said very clearly, we wouldn't want a public sector bank that could offer better terms to customers. It would be uncompetitive. And what he meant by that very clearly is that if you have a public sector bank, it can borrow more cheaply, it can give better interest rates to savers, offer lower rates to borrowers, and it can act in the public interest. It can make sure the evictions that happened of Northern Rock customers, massive amount of defaults on mortgages and repossessions, that didn't have to happen. And the rest of the banking sector was absolutely terrified that that Labour would suddenly, rip off its Tory blue shirt that it had had on for the last 20 years and become a Labour government again, that nationalised things and ran things in the public interest. And so they were very clear, this cannot happen. This cannot happen, it would be uncompetitive. And what he meant by that, it would offer a better deal to customers and might damage the rest of the private sector banks.
So we can see where their priorities lie. But what about the situation we're in now? Is that a lot of the figures are indicating a turnaround in the run-up to the next general election. The austerity plans, many people are saying, I'm afraid, against what you're saying here, austerity has worked. The economy is now starting to pick up again, and it's going to be actually in quite good shape, ready for next year's general election.
I'd say, what are we measuring? If you want to look at GDP, then yes, the figures have picked up. It's finally, after 5 years of stagnation, we finally got a modest bit of growth, and that, that's not to be dismissed, but it's not good. If you look at what the Institute for Fiscal Studies is saying, it's saying that actually the average household is £1,500 worse off today than they were before the crash. Now that to me isn't a recovery. If you look at unemployment, it's still high by historical standards. It's about 2.3 million at the moment. On top of that, you've got about nearly 1.5 million people who are in part-time work who want a full-time job. You've got about 800,000 people who are in temporary work who want a permanent job, a secure contract for a job. And you've got several others who are being hidden through a variety of sanctions and workfare and other, punitive welfare measures. There has been no recovery for the majority of people in this country. We've seen the cost of living crisis, which is perhaps not the catchiest phrase, but it's a point Labour, to its credit, has banged on about. Is real. Rail fares are going up well above inflation. Electricity and gas prices going up well above inflation.
Second class postage stamps going up. Just talking about earlier on, by nearly 50%, the second class postage stamp has gone up over the last 2 years.
Absolutely, and people's wages aren't rising to meet those costs. We are becoming worse off, and our economy isn't creating the sort of well-paid, skilled jobs that actually Britain, as a workforce, is qualified to do. So people are wasting their talents in fairly low grade, low paid jobs that really aren't exploiting or utilising would be a better word, the skills of this country. So there's absolutely no recovery. And if you look at Osborne's projections in the budget, where he says growth will be 2.7% this year and 2.3% next year, they're all based on rising household debt. Exactly what got us into this mess
in the first place. Yeah, quite right. Also, I mean, I agree with you. I'm not sure I like this cost of living crisis phrase. I mean, maybe the pound in your pocket, they used to call it, I think, back when I were a lad. I suppose essentially it's about having a disposable income shrinking, and actually a negative disposable income. And we've all heard all about this. Many people have heard it. Many people have felt it. Many people have seen it when it comes to paying their bills. But ultimately, you as someone who's got your head around this, we hope. What's the way of the most effective, efficient, quickest, simplest way of getting around this, so that we can start to actually push back and find that we've got a little bit more than we need every week, rather than a little bit less? Because that's actually what it's all about: being able to pay the bills and have a decent quality of life with a few pennies in our pocket. I mean, we had a report from the Independent last week saying people have got a really bad quality of life. They can't afford to do simple things like go to the pub and go out to the cinema, for example.
Yeah, and that's bad for the rest of the economy, because those are the things that the rest of the economy needs, the retail economy needs, to survive itself.
So how do we fix it, Andrew? How do we fix it?
I think there are two or three simple things. One, this government came in and it immediately raised VAT. It doesn't talk about it now at all. It talks about how they've raised the tax threshold at the bottom. But actually, they put VAT up from 17.5% to 20%. Now, that immediately put up the cost of living for everybody. And VAT is a flat tax. You know, everybody pays it at the same rate, at 20%. And it's a tax, disproportionately, that hits the lowest paid. Because, you know, proportionately, more of their salary and spending goes, you know, they have to spend their salary in order to survive, and they get hit by VAT. So reduce VAT as a regressive tax, that'd be one thing. The living wage is important. I mean, there were figures out yesterday, something like 43% of people in Ian Duncan Smith, the Work and Pensions Secretary, in his constituency, aren't paid the living wage. Now, if you pay people a decent salary, they will spend it. And that's the simple fact of, you know, people need to spend money in order to survive if they're on low or medium incomes. You know, they don't hoard it, they don't put it offshore, they don't invest it in speculative, you know, markets abroad. They spend it in their local economy. And that is a really important thing. And that's why we're in the mess we're in to a large extent, because this was going on before the crisis and has continued and, in fact, intensified through it. So the living wage is a very important thing. And there's I paraphrase, but it's a quote from Bob Crowe, recently departed secretary of the RMT union. He said, "Why is it that there's a minimum wage that doesn't pay the basic standard of living? If there's a living wage, surely that should be the minimum wage. Otherwise, we're not a dignified society and we just let bosses off the hook." And I think he's right, because how is it that there can be a living wage, which is the basic standard that people need in order to live a semi-decent existence, and that is way above what our minimum wage is? I mean, that's deeply problematic. So it's a pound in people's pockets. And the same thing for people who are on benefits. You know, we've decided throughout this crisis that people on disability benefits and unemployment benefit must pay. You know, their benefits have been capped at 1%. You know, their standard of living has gone down, and from a very low base. You know, these are people in poverty who are claiming employment support allowance or job seekers allowance. So we actually do need to raise benefit levels as well. But the other thing about raising wages is actually you cut benefits. And the reason you do that is because a lot of people in work are having to rely on tax credit and housing benefit just to keep a roof over their heads. And that is really, you know, that is the state subsidising low pay and extortionate landlords. And I see no reason, you know, I don't think when William Beveridge and Aniram Bevan and the Attlee government created the welfare state, they thought it was to prop up low-paying employers and rich landlords. But that's what we're doing. So there's a whole range of things we can do, but there's a kind of silence.
Finding the political will. Just to move on to another topic, Andrew Fisher, there was an interesting report in the US, I think it was in the Washington Post the other day, five banks in the US failing the Federal Reserve stress test. Even after having been bailed out, these banks, they're now starting to look like they're teetering again. Is this real? Is it possible? Is it going to be feasible to bail them out again, or this time is there going to be no choice but to have a crash?
I think that's an interesting question. I think it's a question that will hit Britain within the next couple of years as well, because if interest rates go up in the UK, then there are a lot of people who are on the brink with their mortgages, you know, who are, you know, struggling to meet their mortgage costs. I mean,
let's just focus on the US for a second, because if these banks do go down in the US, it's going to just be like a tsunami coming across the Atlantic.
It depends on the size of those banks, absolutely. I mean, if they are the big international banks...
We're talking about Citigroup, HSBC, North American Holdings, RBS, Citizens Financial Group, Santander, and Zions Bancorp all failed the Federal Reserve stress tests last week.
And it's hardly surprising, because in the US you've got the same phenomenon happening. People's wages aren't going up, and therefore they're borrowing more, and they're getting into more debt. And when people default on those debts, the banks have to write off those losses. You know, if people haven't got the assets or the income in order to pay them, they have to be written off. And when banks have to do that en masse, then other banks don't lend to them because they realise their asset base is weakened, and that's what happened in what we called the credit crunch.
So I suppose what I'm saying is there enough money for another bailout if these banks come back and say, well, sorry guys, we've been fined so much that we're going to have to ask for another bailout, otherwise we're going to explode?
I think the answer is quite clearly no, and the question therefore is what would governments do differently this time? And that really leads to some very unpalatable choices. You either go down the kind of Greek route, I suppose, which is, you know, you really start smashing into the welfare state and public services on a scale that even we haven't seen here. Or you do what I suggested earlier, which is you nationalise them and you start operating them in the public interest.
I suppose that means that those cash points stop becoming HSBC cash points and they just become British government cash points, and the government is so-called, anyway, safeguarding that cash. Anyway, I just wonder what your thoughts are about the economic climate for the next year or so, and whether you think that the economy will be in a decent shape by the end of the year and in time for the next election, Andrew.
I think we're headed for another crisis, and that may or may not come this side of the election. It may come the other side of it. What's for sure is that our economy is not in a good state. And again, I go back to what I said earlier. How do you measure this? Do you measure it in terms of GDP, which is basically, you know, the amount of money flowing around the economy in different transactions? That's one measure. It's very hard to measure. The ONS, who measures it, says it's difficult to measure, and it's, you know. And so, therefore, the accuracy of it, figures are constantly revised.
You know, what occurs to me is that, you know, they're relying on the banks, and we know that that sometimes those figures that are circulated on balance sheets aren't actually the true accurate figures.
Well,
so,
I mean, effectively, the valuation of the banks pre-crisis was the valuation of scam artists. That's what it was. I mean, we bailed out the valuation of scam artists for shareholders and you know, the large investors in banks, people who had, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of pounds in the bank, were bailed out. But I think the real crisis, if you look at the fundamentals of the British economy, it's incredibly weak. We have a low-skilled, low-pay economy where people's living standards are falling. Unemployment is at historically high levels, even though it's dropped slightly in recent times. You know, those fundamentals aren't going to change between now and the general election.
And so it sounds to me like you're saying that really government intervention, nationalisation is going to be the only option at some point.
It's the only option, I think, that's palatable to the electorate, and I think if it happens pre-election, then I think that will be the way they have to go, because the other option is you get into the kind of Greek situation whereby, you know, you're flogging off islands and you're cutting the basic state pension by, you know, large percentages, laying off hundreds of thousands of people all over again. I just don't think that's politically feasible in this country at the moment.
Okay, Andrew, could you just tell us about your book and when it's out? It's The Failed Experiment.
Yeah, it's out on the 20th of May, and it's really a book about the economic consensus that led to the crash. So I think there's been a lot of kind of quite glib, and, you know, it's not entirely unfair, blame of the bankers and speculators and spivs in the city who caused the crisis. But we've got to take a bit of responsibility and empower ourselves in this as well. And it was politicians who let that happen. Politicians decided to deregulate the finance sector. They decided to flog off most of their levers over the economy, most of our industry, to abandon any idea of an industrial strategy, of managing the economy in any way, shape or form. They said that the market will do it. And politician after politician for the last 30 years has done that. And so the book is about rejecting that consensus, looking at the damage that consensus has done, and then suggesting an alternative. And that's an alternative that reevaluates our whole economy. What is it for? Is our economy about making, you know, a few people in the city multi-millionaires, or is it about providing a decent standard of living for every citizen in the UK? I come down on the latter side, and I think that's what a democratic economy should do, you know? And that's really, I guess, the argument is, do we want an economy that's democratic, or do we want an economy that is the law of the jungle?
Okay, former parliamentary researcher, now writer, the book called The Failed Experiment, Andrew Fisher, thanks very much for joining us on the Politics Show this evening.
Thanks very much.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This
Martin.
Is BCFM 93.2.
Martin, I have to ask you what you make of that analysis of things.
Well, it's obviously I agree with a great deal of it. I think the real problem is that we should have been doing all these the things that he was suggesting in the last 5 years. It's getting later and later. And another point I would make is once you've bailed the banks out, you're no longer in a free market philosophy anyway. I mean, some of the serious free marketeers know very well, because once you've bailed the banks out, the allocation of resources beyond that point simply becomes a political allocation of resources. Nothing to do with the market at all. So all these people who are making money are not making money because they deserve to have it. They're making money because they have the political power to insist that they are bailed out. And of course the bankers have a great deal more power than the unemployed and people of that sort. And it's nothing to do with the market at all. I mean, intellectually that is defeated. It's gone.
Okay, well, we're joined now by Diane Scrafton. Hi, Diane, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony.
Diane, you're from the one of the directors, in fact, of Trash Horfield, and a resident who lives about 250 metres away from the memorial ground. Now, as someone as a director, are you actually a trader up on the Gloucester Road or not?
No, I'm not a trader. I'm a resident, a local resident, someone okay. that's lived in the area for
okay.
a while.
Why did you get involved with the campaign then?
I suddenly discovered fairly late in the day that they were planning to put a huge supermarket, much bigger than we'd been led to believe in the locality, and I really felt that it was totally inappropriate in such a densely residential area to put something the size of Tesco Eastgate, but even larger, and on roads that are, you know, just normal thoroughfares, which really are always very congested, and a lot of people using cycles and pedestrians as well. Schools, people, young children walking to school every day, just seems to me to be totally inappropriate.
Why have you been so critical about the actual local politicians up there, though, and who particularly?
We've been very disappointed with the two MPs in the area. The memorial ground.
Who are they? Let's okay. name some names here.
Okay. We have Charlotte Leslie, MP for Bristol North West, who's a Conservative, and we have Stephen Williams, MP for Bristol West, who is Liberal Democrat. So they're part of the coalition, and they've worked as a coalition on this. The memorial ground lies right on the border of the two constituencies. Literally, the road that goes in front of it divides the two constituencies, and that also applies to the wards. So we've had Charlotte Leslie, who in it's not in her constituency, the memorial ground where the development will be. It's outside of her constituency, but she's been very, very vocal about this, and has been, we think, very careless about her her attitude towards the local residents. She's gone on maintaining that everybody wants a supermarket and it'll be very good for the city, and we need a big stadium because we're losing out on this to other cities locally, and making up, well, not making up, but putting forward various sort of large arguments, which she's stuck by throughout. But I think really a lot of people feel that what she should have done as an MP was also to at least listen to the concerns of the community, the people that were protesting, and these are residents and traders. The traders on the Gloucester Road are a wonderful high street, but no effort at all was really made to do that and to take on their concerns.
And we were hearing earlier on about there was a question at Prime Minister's Questions this week about planning in Gloucestershire, saying that actually the planning inspectors don't really care if they get 10,000 letters about a particular application. What they're looking at is the figures and the money, and when Sainsbury's concerned, the figures add up.
I think this is absolutely right. I mean, we know from, you know, the judge doing the judicial review, I mean, what swung it seems to be is the fact that, you know, seeing the bigger picture, and the developments in South Gloucestershire seem to outweigh the impacts on people that live locally in terms of traffic congestion and air pollution, and the people that have their businesses on the Gloucester Road who are going to suffer. We know for a fact that, you know, some of those businesses will go out. That was, you know, accepted at the Planning Committee at the judicial review, and probably the local co-op up there in the north end of the Gloucester Road will go out. And that's one of the anchor shops, which, you know, help underpin the livelihood of all those other shops in the area.
Now, it's called the Memorial Ground, isn't it? Do you know what it's actually a memorial for? I mean, is that word? I mean, I would imagine that it is actually a memorial for or to someone or something.
Very much a memorial. It was land donated to the city of Bristol in honour and in memory of the fallen rugby players of the city. It's a patch of land that used to be regularly used, but it was a rough land, and it was then after the war in 1921 when a lot of the war memorials.
First World War. Of course, we're going through all the anniversary of that, and we'll be talking about it with Martin a little bit later. But gosh, so that's a land donated as a memorial to the dead of the First World War who were in some way involved in sport or whatever.
That's correct.
And that land is just now being sold off for profit to Sainsbury's.
To have a supermarket put on it.
Unbelievable, really, that kind of ignorance, really, of those lives that were lost. But you've lost, haven't you, as a campaign. Where are you going now?
We have lost. Well, we very much want to see that Sainsbury's do not build on that war memorial. And at the moment, there's a petition out there for people to put their names on if they find the whole concept of a supermarket just totally disregarding a war memorial that was not only gifted to the city, but people fundraised a lot to put up the facilities around it early in the century. So a big contribution from the city, people of Bristol. The petition can be found at 38 degrees or just Google Sainsbury's War Memorial and that will bring it up at the top. We'd very much encourage people to sign this to show their offence, their disgust at the idea of a supermarket being built on the War Memorial.
But Diana, I mean, what is this difference is it actually going to make to your life in the future when or if this Sainsbury's is built there? Because surely all it will mean is, well, it's a little bit more convenient actually. You can just pop down to Sainsbury's, whatever it is, you say 250 metres, what's that, a couple of 100 yards down the road and buy whatever you want.
I think we've got a surfeit of supermarkets. We can already pop down the road and get whatever we want, Tony. This is the thing. We've got 14 supermarkets within a 3-mile radius of the site. It's ridiculous. I think, you know, that is a big, big issue. And the fact that, you know, it would be possible to just walk the 250 metres from my house to another supermarket is not anything attractive. The one thing that is quite good would be that the Rovers, if they get their stadium out in South Gloucestershire or anywhere else, will free up the parking at certain times of the week, which I know has been a problem for many people. But what it's going to do is going to bring in 2 million shoppers a year into our residential area, and we're looking at thousands and thousands of cars. We're looking at really on average about 6,500 cars a day coming in. I mean, it just seems to be ridiculous.
I'm playing devil's advocate here a little bit, right, but surely all you're thinking about is the value of your property and what's going to happen to that with this giant great load of bricks descending from on high right next to where you live. I mean, is it going to affect the property prices around there, surely?
Well, it could do. I mean, that's really not of relevance for me. I think what's more important is the air quality in the area with the traffic congestion. It is at the moment. There's very seldom a day when you walk out and you actually think, oh, the air smells really good. It feels fresh. It tastes fresh. We have too much air pollution, or as it is already. We're right on the edge of an air quality management area to introduce, you know, that volume of cars. And you've got to bear in mind also that in North Bristol, we're already going to be badly affected by the developments out at Filton Airport. We're looking at an immediate build of some five almost 6,000 houses out there. And with Southmead Hospital's just about to come online. I mean, it's May 2014. We're talking about next month. And that's also got, you know, it's got implications for the traffic and the services which are going to be using the hospital. And I cannot understand why there has not been more joined up thinking on this front and the way the local politicians have just blustered their way through on this. A blunderbuster, it's kind of they've just decided to go for this and not pay any attention to the local
community. Well, I'll tell you why. It's because money and the supermarket markets are the real power in this land. The people, I'm afraid, don't really feature.
Well, it's really poor show, I think, if that is the case, because we have we have a government here where we have members of parliament representing local communities in the central government, and they really should take on more responsibility for doing that business of fairly representing their constituents, instead of just, you know, following the money, the big money, and deciding that that is really, you know, what counts.
Okay, well, Diana Scrafton, good luck for the future. Thanks very much for joining us
on the Politics Show
this evening.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, her name is Sarah Badge, and she's the wife of Philip Wood. He was an IBM executive on the missing Malaysian airliner MH370, and she gave an interview last weekend to the BBC. Let's have a listen to what she had to say.
It's starting to feel like it's an intentional series of distractions, is what it feels like. You know, they spent a week looking in one place. Oops, that's the wrong place. And then they shifted to another because of evidence. And then that's the wrong place. So they shifted again. And at the end of this prior shift, the government was so certain that they had the right location that they made a pronouncement that the flight was down and everybody was dead. But now they've got new evidence. So apparently the old evidence wasn't correct, so they must have to withdraw that original statement because they can't be certain anymore. So now there's a new place. You know, it's just like a magician playing tricks on the audience. It's frustrating. I think we are all being hoodwinked at this point. And, you know, if they end up coming up with real wreckage of the plane, then I'll take my words back, because it is possible that I'm just at a frustration point, that I'm no longer being rational. But it just seems ridiculous that a flight that size could have evaded all scrutiny in today's world. I do believe he could still be alive, because there's actually no evidence that points to a crash. You know, if every crime requires intent and requires motive and means, so they have the means of the plane, we don't know the intent, but if you're going to go to all the trouble to take an airplane filled with relatively valuable people, I mean, there were 30 defense contracting engineers with very unique skill sets on that flight. It would have been a valuable prize for a country looking to gain advantage in military weaponry, right? So there would be a lot of motivation to get a hold of that flight. I see no motivation for somebody to have just crashed it. I don't much follow the news because it would be just an agonizing cycle. But through the website that we have launched on Facebook, it's called Finding Philip Wood, we've had a number of experts in the industry reach out to us, you know, former pilots, people with military or security types of experience. I've had access to a large number of experts through my contacts in the media. Without reservation, all of them believe that this flight has been taken, not crashed. And so I don't understand why all of the government efforts are only looking in the water. So if they're ignoring the thing right in front of their face, it must be on purpose. So I can only believe that this is just one giant distraction while something else is happening behind the scenes. I have absolutely no contact with any authorities, Malaysian, Chinese, or up until yesterday, actually, I had no contact with the American authorities either. I mean, I'm one civilian individual. I am no expert in espionage or world politics, but I'm just using common sense, and I'm looking at the vast majority of what all people feel with common sense and intuition seems to have happened in this case, and most people feel that the governments are misleading us.
The governments are misleading us. And it was the first time I've heard her say that all of the people who are relatives of the people who disappeared believe that the plane did not crash, Martin. This is pretty shocking stuff. And also, I mean, I was pointing out in an article I wrote yesterday on the RT site that the The aircraft, we know now that the aircraft made zigzag patterns back across, west across Malaysia, off into the Indian Ocean. This is exactly the same sort of pattern that was we saw on 9/11 when the planes were hijacked. So something very strange. I mean, maybe it means that these were hijacked, but why would an airplane make zigzag patterns, maybe even changing a level, its level?
Well, I mean, in that case, it's just possibly not hijacked, because, of course, on 9/11, you can't actually fly by sight at 30,000 feet. So if the planes are not, in fact, flying directly to the targets, as they didn't, then how did they get to the targets? And that implies that they were probably flown from the ground. So that's that wasn't carried out by a small terrorist group. That's probably a state agency doing that.
Hugo Tiso, we've pointed out a few times on here, was a commercial pilot. He, at the Hack in the Box conference in April 2013, demonstrated his ability to change the speed, the altitude and the direction of a virtual aeroplane by sending radio signals to its in-flight management system just from an Android smartphone. So it doesn't sound like the most complicated thing to do. Almost certainly a pod on a US or other military fighter or an AWACS aircraft, certainly that's one of those ones with a big radar dome on the front. They are designed and built for electronic warfare.
Yes, well, the Global Hawk technology was perfected in the 1970s, and the US flew a plane across the Pacific to Australia without a pilot. And if you think about it, given the level of technology now in IT and so on, the idea that you can fly something remotely is fairly straightforward. Well, the question is, who's taking these planes over, and why are they doing it?
Well, who has the motive? Because the US were putting pressure at the time on China to vote with them at the United Nations Security Council on the Crimea vote, because the plane disappeared just under a week before a very important vote at the UN Security Council over China, which China actually abstained from rather than voted with the US. So there may have been some geopolitical pressure, but there have been quite a lot of these geopolitical angles to past plane crashes. So give us your Hereford Triangle, Martin.
Well, I mean, planes started to be played as part of geopolitical pawns, if you like, during the 1970s, when hijacking became popular. Leila Khaled, the famous Palestinian hijacker, was one of the initial lone rangers, if you like, of that. But I mean, the West has often used, and other political forces have used planes, because planes are very visible. Planes are very, people can see planes.
Not this one.
No, I know, but I mean, the point is that
apart from in the Maldives,
yes, messages can be sent with planes. So, for example, I suppose people will remember in the 1980s, the KAL 500, I think it was, that was overflew the Sakhalin Peninsula. It was a South Korean airliner, overflew the Sakhalin Peninsula, which is the most secret part of the Russian military industrial complex, and it was shot down by the Russians to, you know, howls of outrage from the West. But R.W. Johnson of Magdalen College in Oxford wrote a book about all of this, and he proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that this was a provocation. So, for example, former President Richard Nixon was going to get on that plane and was stopped at the gate and told, don't get on that plane. And the plane, in fact, flew over, was deliberately flown over the most secret part of the Russian military industrial complex, and the Russians shot it down. So the Russians are then put in a double bind. They either shoot it down or they manage to take lots of secret photographs of their stuff. But it was definitely a provocation by the West. The Reagan and Thatcher administrations, particularly the Reagan administration, were behind that. So, and then we've also got the Lockerbie incident, where now it's being suggested that in actual fact it wasn't the Libyans that bombed the Lockerbie plane. It might in fact have been the Iranians via the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine in Beirut. But one thing is absolutely for certain, I don't know whether that's true, there's a third theory that it's to do with a CIA drugs run. But the fact of the matter is that all independent analysis suggests that it was nothing to do with the Libyans. The whole idea that a piece of baggage went through two baggage checks without a passenger to plant the bomb on the plane at Frankfurt, it just doesn't make any sense at all. And it probably, one of the suggestions by Susan Landau, as an ex-CIA agent, was that it was actually the CIA blew up the plane because it had people on the plane who were going back to report to their superiors about CIA drug running in the Lebanon. Now that's still not resolved, but of course what was going to happen, the Megrahi had to be released because the local police inspector was was going to testify at his appeal that the CIA had tampered with the crime scene, to wit, implanting a circuit board which implicated the Libyans. Now, in other words, the CIA have been interfering with a crime scene in Scotland in order to point the finger at the wrong people for what happened. That is crime of a high order, isn't it, when you think about all the people that died. Then, of course, we've got the underpants bomber getting on the plane Schiphol, I think it was, and to fly across, and he wasn't even checked. We've got eyewitnesses who saw him getting on the plane
without a passport,
without a security check, and then it turns out he's got supposedly a bomb with him. Now, who controls the security at Schiphol Airport? It's an Israeli-based company called ICTS, and they also control.
This is they provide airport security.
Yes, you privatise airport security. And of course, these private Israeli companies are at the top because they're the experts on hijacking and so forth. So they then take over the security in Schiphol. And they also, at the same company, ICTS, controlled all three airports from which the planes took off on 9/11. So I think when you actually control security in an airport, it's quite easy to fake incidents which are designed to have certain political effects. I'll put it no stronger than that. But planes are used because public transport in general, like the bombing of Bologna railway station and the Madrid, they're going after trains. But planes, it's shocking, it's spectacular, it has the desired effect on people's psychology.
Martin, we mentioned briefly Ukraine there as a possible motive. The UN Security Council decision, a possible motive to really put a finger in China's eye by the US. But this week we had a big discussion about it. NATO meeting, a ministerial meeting in Brussels, and one of their spokespeople is the big head honcho of NATO's armed forces, that is Philip Breedlove, and here he is, followed by a quotation, a little speech from President Obama.
Yesterday we heard the first indications that there might have been a pullback, and yesterday we did not see any evidence of pulling back, and we reported that to the ministers here in the first day of the conference. Over the evening last night, we have seen one of the units moving, but I would not be able to characterize it right now as moving back or moving back to garrison for sure.
He's talking about the Russians.
Seen movement of one of the small elements of this very large force on the Ukrainian border. Our estimate is the force is about 40,000 strong. 40,000 doesn't tell the story. This is a combined arms army with all of the pieces necessary should there be a choice to make an incursion into Ukraine. So supported by fixed-wing aircraft, rotary-wing aircraft, all of the logistics required in order to successfully make an incursion if they needed. This force is a force built for an incursion into Ukraine if required. I really see sort of three opportunities here. One, for the force to sit at rest through this period of negotiation and possibly all the way through the presidential elections as a coercive force. The second is the force may be used along the southern part of Ukraine in order to establish a land track to the forces in Crimea. And then it would have the option of carrying on into possibly Odessa or beyond and give them options there. And clearly, the forces that is assembled, if chosen, could be used for a limited incursion into a broader part of eastern Ukraine.
Today, NATO planes patrol the skies over the Baltics, and we've reinforced our presence in Poland, and we're prepared to do more. Going forward, every NATO member state must step up and carry its share of the burden.
I suppose he means Britain too. Also talking about NATO, the Bilderberger conference was announced by the Bilderbergers themselves to be in Denmark this year at the end of May. I may well be trotting down there to see that. And Bilderberg is really NATO's political lobbying arm. They've got a lot of the military these days in there. They've got the banks from the NATO countries all telling the politicians basically what to do. And let's hope that there's a bit more coverage of it in the press here, because it's a very important group. But Martin, we've also heard this week from the CIA or from the US that the CIA has been misleading the US government and the public about aspects of its brutal interrogation program for years. They're now talking about revealing some of this report today. They're concealing details about the severity of the methods, overstating the significance of plots and prisoners, and taking credit for critical pieces of intelligence that detainees had surrendered well before they were actually ever subjected to any kind of torture techniques. So we can't really trust these people, can we? And there they are. There's the head of NATO there, the chief guy of NATO, saying that we've got to be worried about Russian incursions into Ukraine.
Well, I mean, the independent US journalists have been in to Russia to see if there's any troops there, and they're reporting that there aren't any. I think what's happening here is they're talking the crisis up rather than talking the crisis down. I can see that the West doesn't like what Putin has done in the Crimea, and he's not going to change his mind, and they're not going to change theirs. But what seems to be happening is instead of talking the crisis down and seeing ways to resolve it, they're trying to find ways to talk it up. And that's because NATO needs an enemy. Otherwise, why do we need NATO? And of course, that is a big question. Why do we need NATO?
If we don't need NATO, maybe we don't need the Bilderbergs either.
No. And maybe we don't need any enemies either.
Okay, now on to Clive Menzies. He's from Occupy London. We spoke to him a couple of weeks ago about the hollowing out of our democracy by big business, transatlantic big business, and the European Union. But now he's going to tell us about some more positive stuff, that is, his ideas about reform.
Nearly half the cost of everything is interest. So when you buy a railway ticket, 50% of the cost of your railway ticket is the cost of the carriages, the rolling stock, and all the infrastructure, all the money that's borrowed. Now, if you didn't have to pay that interest, if that money was created without interest, which it could easily be, it's been done before, this is not unprecedented, then you halve the cost of everything, first and foremost. Secondly, if you actually share the value of the land, then you can actually start abolishing taxes. Also, you're abolishing benefits, because you wouldn't need unemployment benefit. You wouldn't need to have means testing for anything. There's still the issue of disability benefits, but that's a separate issue. But leaving that aside, unemployment benefits, state pension, abolish them all. You wouldn't need to employ people in that. And you'd save all the costs. Everybody talks about the demographic time bomb. How are we going to pay all these old people? Well, if you applied assistance income, you don't need to worry about the demographic time bomb. So if we shared the value of the land and we didn't let the bankers steal all the wealth through the mechanism of interest, then citizens' income becomes affordable, and you could probably do away with most income tax and employment taxes as well. And it would create a very different society. One of the things that we're working on within the critical thinking group and other groups are working on is actually mapping out this blueprint and putting figures to it. But it stands to reason that if 85 people own as much wealth as half the global population, in other words, 3.5 billion people, and I did calculate it, something like 0.00000007% of the population own as much as 50%, then we know that the means is there. The wealth exists. What we have is a system that extracts the wealth from the majority and drives it to the few. And so if we remove those three flaws, share the value of the land, abolish interest, and provide everybody with the citizens' income, society would be much fairer and much more equal. But in order to do that, we need full participatory democracy, because representative democracy clearly hasn't worked.
That's a good point, Clive. I mean, in order to achieve what you're saying, we would need a serious overhaul in the whole democratic structure, not only of this country, but because we're part of the EU. So what could be the first step along that way?
Well, I think the danger is that any country which adopts this becomes a target for military aggression. Because clearly, if you look at the history, power is vested in a very small number of hands globally. There was a study produced in October 2011 which showed that 147, what they described, super entities, they own 40% of a network of transnational corporations. So what this study did, it studied 43,060 transnational corporations, global corporations, looked at the share ownership, the directors, and looking at common directorships and shareholdings, they came down to 40% of that network is controlled by just 147 super entities or global corporations. Of those, and in addition to controlling 40%, they were controlling 60% of the revenues, which basically means if you control 60% of global trade, you run the world. Now, what that study didn't look at was who actually owns those 147. But from all the work that I've done, behind those 147 entities are a small number of dynasties. So the Vanderbilts, the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, the Morgans, the Harrimans, the Bushes are involved in some respects. I mean, there are a number of families that basically control the world. So we do need full democracy. And representative democracy has been given grudgingly by the powers that be in order to keep people quiet. But clearly, it doesn't operate in our interests. So we do need to dismantle or re-engineer our democracy. And for that to happen, people need to have the time and the freedom and access to information in order to participate fully. So a citizen's income is a prerequisite, but also the media. In America, 90% of the media is owned by just six corporations. In this country, it's not dissimilar. So all the information we get is propaganda. It's basically for the interests of those who benefit from the system. So we need access to open information, which the internet provides to a degree, but there's a lot of misinformation through NSA surveillance and manipulation. There's a lot of propaganda that comes via the internet, specifically targeted at activists and progressives. So it needs a much better understanding of the way the world works. And to achieve that, people need to understand more. So it's a bit of a chicken and egg, because until you get control of the media, how do you teach people? And what Occupy was about around the world was actually trying to understand and share information. So when you say, how do we get this done? This has to be global, and that's why Occupy is so important, because Occupy hasn't gone away globally.
Martin, we're talking about these super entities, and actually what he's saying there is effectively the world is run, or the Western world anyway, in a kind of dynastic feudal basis.
Well, yes, and I think I very much appreciated what he's saying there about citizens' income, because citizens' income is the answer to the crisis for many people. Instead of bullying people to take jobs that they don't want and don't need, if they've got a citizen's income, then you flexibilise the labour market.
We've run out of time again, I'm afraid. The clock on the wall is wrong. But we'll be back next week. I'm Tony Gosling. We're online at thisweek.org.uk. See you next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour.